So I've got to start out with kind of the playground, and you're coming up with that play. I know it was obviously somewhat biographical, but tell me about, you know, what caused you to want to go that route and tell that play and be so open about, you know, telling something that obviously is something passionate in your life.
Yeah, I was in New York City, and I was struggling. You know, I was an actor and a director in New York City, and I was kind of struggling. I'd lost our job. It was kind of like we couldn't find jobs. My girlfriend and myself and my best friend moved into this like little tiny apartment. We basically lost all our money. We weren't talking to our parents at the time, and the only place that, you know, I started going to, like, what kind of places could we get money? And I started going to this prostitute bar that they were offering us money. And I was like, I never did it. But I was like, as I was looking at their lifestyle, I started interviewing them. And I started interviewing these kids that they were hanging out with on the street. And I'm like, wow, this is something here. So I started writing all this stuff, and it became the playground.
So crazy.
All the kind of based on all these interviews, I interviewed all these kids, yeah.
So when you decided, you know, years later, you've met some of these kids that have come to the play, but you decide to do the PSA. What made you go that route? What made you decide to do it that way in the beginning?
Once, you know, the show was up, and of course we're bringing all these organizations together and these kids to come see it, you know, you put a face to the, you know, to the problem, and you're like, wow, you know, I'm literally talking to these kids. And the one girl that came, who was 16, she was going to help me with the show. She's like, I really like what you're doing here. Let's just work on this and work on this. And her name was Raven. And, you know, the show was still running, and she was murdered. And I was like, this is way bigger than a play. Let me go out and get the world to know about this. So let me go out and get all this information from all these kids. And as I was out there, that 2 minutes, it's too short of a time to really tell all their stories, and that became the feature documentary.
Was there a moment, I mean, we get to see you kind of break open the kids, I mean, idea of being open to you, but was there something that sticks with your mind that allowed you to connect with these kids? I mean, was there a moment where you realized, okay, I think I can do something bigger here. I'm connecting with some of these kids like Bubbles.
It's Bubbles. Yeah, she was great. She's like my bodyguard on the street, which you wouldn't think a 16-year-old girl would be, but she was. It's when you get out there and you start interviewing and hearing their stories, and once they kind of realize that you're not exploiting them and that you're here for the right reason, because I had them be on my crew. I was like, I need your guys' help. Let's get this message out there together. And once they came a part of the crew and came a part of the story with me, I couldn't just leave them there. It was just like, once you're looking into their eyes and you're seeing a kid, you know, all right, good night. You know, everyone was asking, what is the most disturbing thing that happened for me? And I saw everything, heroin, anything, death. I could see everything. It's when you're working with them all day and you're dropping them off and they look at you with their backpack and their sleeping bag and like, all right, see it. You don't know if you're going to see them the next day. That to me, it's not even, it is connection, but it's just humanity. These kids are 16, 17 years old. How do you just leave them there? So you get invested. And I think a lot of people just kind of, they see it on the streets, they give money, or they just, oh, this is horrible. But once you get invested, that these are human beings, this is just like you and me, you just can't stop.
You know, I was amazed when I looked on the website, sparesomechange.org. You have so many kids that are in the movie but aren't the main characters, and I was amazed at all the different states that these kids are from. I found some from Texas, which was amazing to me. I mean, I'm here in Texas, and I was blown away by that. Can you talk about just this being more than just California or New York or the streets people may think? This is affecting the nation.
Absolutely. There's 2 million kids on the street, right? So 18,000 in Los Angeles. And every city, every big city has them, right? But as I show this to my family or friends of the family or people that we know, like guidance counselors and teachers are calling me and going, oh my God, that kid who threw the desk or that kid is wearing the same outfit every day, that's one of these kids. And then, you know, they go into the next day and the kid's gone. And I think that teachers and counselors, they're not seeing that this is their future. These kids are their future. So they're in every city, in every hometown. It's just they're fleeing from their home, and they end up in these big cities because there's a little more opportunities there. There's, you know, more shelters or a community that they can be a part of rather than being by themselves in their hometown. Does that make sense?
No, definitely. I think we see that, yeah, especially with a character like Ish, who I think everyone gravitates towards. Can you talk to me about bringing these kids back to your house, the moments that caused you to do that? I think that was some of the more emotionally driven moments. I didn't anticipate that when I watched this, for you to bring them home. That was special.
I definitely didn't either. I think, I don't remember at this point with which kid was first, but I think when I, like I said, I was getting close to Bubbles, and when she called me and said, you know, I just been jumped, and you go there, it's like, you know, they became my family, they became my brothers and sisters. At the time, these kids were similar to my age. I was a little, of course, a little older than them, but, you know, they're like brothers and sisters. And then when you hear your friend is being jumped, or your friend is pregnant on the streets, or your friend is going through this, or someone's trying to rape, you can't, what do? You would do anything, you would just go, all right, come back. And because we were all close with them, I mean, there was a time, I think at Christmas, I had like 10 kids in my house. Mm. And you just can't, it's so difficult. Of course, I had, you know, other members of the crew helping me as well, and some of the crew took them to their house as well. You just don't know how to not do it. Everyone always asks me this question, and to be completely honest, would you leave your brother? Would you leave your cousin? Would you leave, you know, it's just, they're just human. So to me, it wasn't like, wow, I have three kids in my house. At first it was, but then they're just your family, and that's just what it is.
How difficult? No, it definitely does. I mean, thank you for doing it. I think it's important. How hard is it to get back into being so open to the kids that you know, keep relapsing? You know, I think people would have given up on Nick and Greens, but you didn't.
Absolutely.
What made you not do that?
At the time, I've lost all my, I was in the industry and I was doing really well at the moment. And when you look, there's so much hope, and that's the thing, like, they don't feel bad for themselves. There's so much hope and there's so much potential. And look, it's just like with any person, you know, some people have potential, some people are just gonna not know what they want to do with their lives. But when you see the potential and you see them struggling and you see that they just want to get ahead, you just have to keep going. And it's really, it's their circumstance. You know, Nick can be like, Green's like, all right, tomorrow meet me at 10 a.m. and we're going to do this. We're going to fill out these applications. We're going to get you in this thing. And then you go there at 10 o'clock and you meet them and you're like, where the hell, they stood me up? What the hell's going on? And you find out that someone tried to do something to Green's while he's sleeping, or these cops arrested them because they were sleeping on a rooftop. So you realize it's just their circumstances, not really them as a people, but when they're conditioned that they're worthless all day long, you can't stop it. You can't help but going, God, there's more to this than just what they think or what they've been told about themselves. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. One of the things I was fascinated by was when the kids would talk about the horribleness of the foster care, but also when I think it was Nick was talking about the transitional homes and how bad they were.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the lack of real support that even the places that claim to be supportive aren't necessarily all that great for these kids?
Yeah. It is such a tricky thing because anyone who wants to help homeless kids, they want to support, right? But the challenge is that the places that there are out there, right? You got the shelters, you have the outreach centers, which are open for, you know what, 2 hours a day, and they feed them, you know, stuff or whatever. And then you think, okay, if I can just get into transitional living, if I can just get them off the streets in these programs, and you think that they're equipped, they're being funded by the government, you're like, okay, this is a great place. And then you find out that they're just leaving them there with no food, with no money. There's prostitution rings going in and out. I mean, we took Nick right out of that program because it was just like, he's just reliving the streets over and over and over. And that's why, as I've been to pretty much almost every shelter or organization in this town I know of, and I find the runs that match our message, which is like, it's about the individual. If you're feeding 100 kids, how are you ever going to connect to them? So you organize, you align yourself with organizations that have your message. And that's what I had to do. And there are some great ones out there, but there are also some bad ones out there.
On a artistic level, I know you've done plays that are outside of this process, but being able to have made the playground and have, you know, Greens and Nick be a part of the elevator play, do those plays stick out with you more emotionally because of this unique connection to these kids?
Well, since I was young, I mean, my goal is to help change the world with art and get people to think differently than they did when they walked into the theater. So Elevator was a perfect thing for them and for, you know, audiences, because it's about love and it's about connection. And yes, of course, I mean, all my crew was like, what are you doing? Have these guys run your show? I mean, a stage manager's job is very, very complicated. But he ran that show for 10 months. And when I was in New York City directing something else, I mean, he would run that show by himself. So to me, it's emotional because it's, this guy came from the streets and now he's in charge of all these professional actors. It was pretty amazing to see. Yeah, so that always have a special place in my heart because of that time. But all the art that we do as a company is to help shift the energy and shift the vibration in the world.
Do you mind if I ask what the 11/11 experience is and what it means?
Yeah. So 11/11 experience is when you look at the clock and say it's 11/11, right? It's the time where you're aligned with what you're supposed to do in this life. So when you get that number, you look at that number and some people will make a wish or whatever that is, but it's about alignment and about your focus and about you're on your path and what you're supposed to be doing. And I named that company about 10 years ago, and I was just like, this feels right. This is what we're about. This makes sense.
Love it. That's so cool. I've got to ask, one of the characters that we don't get introduced to is your dog or somebody's dog. Who's the dog in the film that is at the house?
That's my dog, Roxy, Golden Retriever.
Very cool. Another element of the movie that I was kind of blown away with that I think also connects with Ish, because I noticed he had a song in the film, but also the great composed work that you had for the film. Can you talk about the music in the documentary?
Yeah, so a lot of it is Ish's music. A lot of it was picked out by the kids. Like, the closing song is Nick's idea, and he sold me on the song. And then it was other composers that we felt shared the message, that got the message. And some of it original. No, it was all composed before, so it wasn't written for the movie, but it was just different artists that connected to the message, and we thought that added the emotional impact that was needed for the movie.
I know we're only a few weeks away from kind of opening it to a group of cities, but with this type of project, are you hoping to do as many cities as possible? I mean, are you looking to expand it?
Absolutely. After this whole experience, you know, I didn't leave my house for a while because, like, I need to recharge. This is insane, right? So what I did is I spent time online and I found state leaders in every state that would represent our movie. So we have state leaders in every state that are willing to take on the movie in each city.
That's
how we're doing that, yeah.
So wonderful. Do you mind if I ask about updates on Misha or Kiki or anyone that... Have you been able to find any of the ones that were lost?
Yeah, so it was amazing. We got into a couple film festivals, and a year and a couple months ago, we did this thing at the Hollywood Film Festival, and I was shooting my new movie about teen suicide. And one of the actors in the movie was like, hey, I saw your trailer. This girl looks familiar. Her name is Markeisha. And I was like, yeah, no, that's not her. Her name's Kiki. He's like, oh, God, I really feel like I know her. And then he started, like, I really know her. And I'm like, and I called Michelle. I'm like, what was Kiki's real name? Because they all have street names, right? So I said, what was Kiki's real name? She's like, I think it was Markeisha. And I'm like, no way. So one of the actors also helped underprivileged kids with spoken word and music. And he goes, she was one of my students. She came from Juvie. She was one of my students. I'm like, what? So within an hour, I got on the phone with her. He found her. And then she came and spoke at the premiere, and now she's speaking all over the world with spoken word. So Kiki is found, and she lived with us over the summer, and she's doing really well. I mean, she got to Hamilton on Broadway, and she spoke with all the people on Broadway and did spoken word for them. Like, she's doing well. Misha is still missing. No one has heard from her, so we do not know where Misha is. A couple of kids have died since the movie. Pretty much everyone is... Nick's doing well. Green's doing well. Bubbles is in school. We just flew in Green tonight. He's getting married in March, so we just flew him in for the premiere tonight. Everyone's doing well at this moment.
What does it mean to you to have people come on board? Because, I mean, like, a couple of years ago, I mean, Rosie O'Donnell's talked about you. I mean, you had, like, Mark A. Burley come on board as a producer. What does it mean that people are jumping on this and are becoming a part of, hopefully, helping these kids?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing the whole time was, you know, why do you do it? Why do you do it? And you want to break the misconceptions of why people, so many people don't even know there's homeless kids on the street. So the fact that we're hoping that the movie has connected to people, that we've given them a voice so they can be seen and heard. And if we can do that and people get that and they want to jump on board to make this even, get this to more people and reach as many audiences as we can, it means the world to us that we've done our job and that they've connected to these kids and they're able to see their hearts. That's the biggest thing for me.
Lastly, Michael, I'd love to know, as far as your writing, do you find yourself wanting to do more documentary work? Do you want to do more plays about this material, or have you been changed by your experiences?
Playground has been offered for a film, a TV series, so we're kind of always in the development with that. As far as documentaries, I go with what I feel at the moment. Like I said, this next movie I'm making is kind of like a documentary. I just finished it. But it's a feature film with actors, but it's about teen suicide. Each topic is important. Like, I have a show running in L.A. right now about the Me Too movement, about what happened to these kids in the industry. So for me, it's every topic. You know, there's so many topics out there to discuss, to, you know, raise awareness about. But yes, the homeless kid thing will be in my soul forever. There's no way I'll always be, you know, wanting that out there. As far as documentaries go, if there's something that I'm moved by that I think I can tell this story the right way, then yeah, I'm always open.
Well, thank you for making this, and I can't wait to see what other work comes out and see what other causes you're getting attached to. I think it's important. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking this time. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks, Sarah.
All right.
Thanks, Scotty. See you later.